It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the rate of people who say they've been diagnosed with depression in the U.S. is reaching new highs. We'll talk to a Wisconsin clinical psychologist about what might be driving that trend and what we can do about it. First, on Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against an unusual legal theory that would give state legislatures complete power to control how federal elections are conducted in their state. According to what's known as the independent legislature theory, state lawmakers could set election laws without having to answer to any checks and balances from other governing bodies in their state, the courts, governor, even the state constitution. The ruling comes from a case in North Carolina. It's called Moore versus Harper, but it could mean a lot for the future of federal elections here in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you watching for this result from the U.S. Supreme Court? What do you make of this idea, this independent state legislature theory? What questions do you have about the ruling, what it means here in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, nice to be here.
Like a lot of legal cases that make their way to the U.S. Supreme Court, Howard, it's kind of a tangled road. Can you give us the highlights and what was ultimately at stake before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Sure, I can. But I think we have to go back all the way to Bush versus Gore, believe it or not, to explain what's going on in this case. So one of the less remarked upon elements in Bush versus Gore, remember that was, of course, a case under very peculiar circumstances, but one of the big arguments was whether the Florida legislature could be bound by the Florida Supreme Court to act in certain ways that the litigants, you know, wanted them to or didn't want them to do. That introduced this idea, or rather in the context of that argument, there was introduced this idea of the independent state legislature doctrine. And the idea is that, as you mentioned in the opening, the Constitution specifies that state legislatures shall determine the manner in which federal elections are held. The claim was that preempts the relationship between the state legislature and, say, the state court, and therefore it preempts the relationship between the state legislature and the state constitution. In North Carolina, the Democratic-dominated Supreme Court struck down a partisan gerrymander on the grounds that it violated the North Carolina Constitution. That was called Harper 1. That was appealed up to the Supreme Court. While that appeal was pending, there was an election, and the North Carolina Supreme Court was taken over by a conservative pro-Republican majority, which promptly overruled the previous Supreme Court's ruling. So the first question was this case moot? Mm-hmm. The U.S. Supreme Court said the case was not moot because even though the North Carolina Supreme Court had determined, I realize this gets complicated, but had determined that under the North Carolina Constitution, there's no rule against partisan gerrymandering, is still the case that new districts had to be drawn and there had to be some standard for what those would be. It's at this point that the theory comes in. One side claimed the North Carolina's legislature can draw any districts they want, untrammeled by any requirements of the state constitution, however they're interpreted. That's the independent state legislature theory. The reason it's so important is that just a couple of years ago, in a case called Lucho versus Common Cause, the Supreme Court ruled that the U.S. Constitution puts no limit on partisan gerrymandering. So in other words, if the theory had been accepted, there would be no possible limitation on gerrymandering, and by extension, no limitation on anything a state legislature did with respect to an election. An extreme case of the theory, following its logical conclusion, you might argue that a state could say, we don't care how the votes came out, we're going to pick the winner of our state in a presidential election based on our preferences and leave it at that. That theory, the Supreme Court rejected. So where we are now is that in North Carolina, it's still the case that the North Carolina Constitution says nothing about partisan gerrymandering, because that was the most recent ruling by their state Supreme Court. But in other states, it may be the case that state Supreme Courts interpreting state constitutions can still put a limitation on that practice.
Looking at the inspiration, part of the inspiration for this independent legislature idea, the elections clause in the Constitution just has the word legislature, and proponents, as I understand it, Howard, say, well, they just say legislature, that means legislature, full stop. It's all them. Other people point out, no, you have to assume the legislature, in the context of being a legislature, guided by its state constitution, with the usual checks and balances. Is that at the heart of some of the debates we see over this?
That's exactly right. And it gets even more abstract and more philosophical and perhaps more absurd than that. Go back to Bush versus Gore again. One doesn't have to. One argument is, and this is the argument, this is the approach that usually applies in essentially all other situations. And that is to say, a state legislature, or the U.S. Congress for that matter, only exists as the creation of its constitution. There would be no U.S. Congress without the U.S. Constitution. There would be no state legislature without the state constitution. Therefore, the word legislature means this thing created under the state constitution by this state, you know, people governing themselves. That's really the more traditional argument. The argument that came out of Bush versus Gore, which is radical, is no, we can do a kind of textualist linguistic game and say that where the word legislature appears in this context, and by the way, this argument is not made where the same word appears in other contexts, but where the legislature appears in this context, it means what I like to call the legislature 2.0, a virtual version unrelated to its usual self, with powers, responsibilities, a position in the system of checks and balances completely different from everything that normally applies. And the argument is that alternative version of the legislature is the one we should be talking about, and it is unlimited by anyone.
Talking to Howard Schwaber. Howard.
I was just going to say, you know, that was a bridge too far even for this court, although it's worth noting there were 3 votes on the current court in favor of that theory. So, you know, no matter how much someone like me might say this is a crazy idea, there's no guarantee it won't come back.
Talking to Howard Schwaber from UW-Madison, affiliate faculty of the law school, emeritus professor of political science, looking at this Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court decision yesterday on this idea of the independent state legislature, how much power a state legislature has to regulate federal elections within the borders of that state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? Rejecting that idea, mostly anyway. Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions for our guest, or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard, some people are saying, wait a minute, part of this ruling leaves the door open for some challenges in federal courts on elections. And at least as reported by NPR, some Republican strategists say the first test case may well come from gerrymandering, partisan boundary lines drawn in Wisconsin, because we're expecting our current state map to go up before the Supreme Court after management of that court changes in August. What are you looking for there?
Again, that's absolutely right. So part of the opinion rejected the independent state legislature theory, but then there was an odd comment in Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, which said federal courts retain a role to step in and prevent state courts from going too far in interfering with the state legislature's conduct of elections. The problem is he did not provide a single word of explanation for what too far means. So at the moment, it's kind of a wild card. There's an open mandate for federal courts to decide in a given case that a given state legislature has gone too far in interfering with what the state legislature wants to do. The reason that's so disturbing, and Wisconsin really is exhibit A for this, has to do with then a separate question. Just this month, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down an Alabama districting program on the grounds that it was racially discriminatory. In February of 2022, the Supreme Court had been offered a chance to do exactly the same thing, but declined to hear the case. And the reason was something called the Purcell Principle. They said, we can't rule on electoral practices too close in time to an election. That might create confusion. The problem was, in that instance, there was 9 months until the next election. So in that case, in Alabama, the Supreme Court said, well, 9 months is too close to an election to make a ruling. And then after the electoral cycle was long over, came and said, oh, by the way, that system of districting was in fact unconstitutional. That's the kind of thing I would worry about federal courts stepping in and doing. So you can imagine a situation where the Wisconsin state legislature, whether as a matter of partisan gerrymandering, which is of course an issue that's going to come up before the court very, very soon, or something else. Think of all the conflicts there were in 2020 during the election about electoral procedures. The Wisconsin Supreme Court issues some ruling, A federal court says, no, we're applying the Purcell principle, and therefore you can't change what the state legislature wanted to do, even though it may turn out to have been unconstitutional under the state constitution. The other piece of this is that while most of the time, I have to say, I resist the idea that you can reduce descriptions of judicial decision-making to partisanship, favoring one party or the other. I usually think it's much more about ideology and beliefs about constitutional principle. In this one area, that is the question of how willing federal courts will be and the U.S. Supreme Court will be to intervene in procedural electoral disputes, here there's been a really, really clear and consistent partisan bias. So the very same U.S. Supreme Court that said 9 months until the election is too short a period of time for a court to step in and change electoral rule, as some people remember, in 2020 was perfectly willing to change a rule about how ballots would be collected 2 days before the election. In other words, this Purcell rule, as it's called, seems to be standardless, infinitely flexible, and used in a highly partisan manner. And that fits right in to the blank check mandate that the Supreme Court has just given federal courts to step in and stop state courts from applying the state constitution whenever doing that goes, quote, too far, whatever exactly that means.
Talking to Howard Schwaber, a political science professor emeritus at UW-Madison, affiliate faculty at the law school, breaking down this new U.S. Supreme Court decision that'll affect future elections in the United States, rejecting this concept of the independent state legislature theory. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have your eye on gerrymandering our district lines here in Wisconsin? Are you hoping for a legal challenge to go to the courts? What do you think of this U.S. Supreme Court ruling saying limiting the powers of state legislatures to run elections, to do things like draw the boundary lines without reference to their state constitutions, their state courts? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus, affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison, talking about a recent Supreme Court decision that rejected the independent state legislature theory, which claimed that state lawmakers could run federal elections in their state without oversight from, say, a state Supreme Court, their state constitution. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about this ruling? What went into it? What was at stake? What it meant for Wisconsin? Do you have a reaction? Do you have thoughts on what is coming out of this? Were you watching this and worried about the outcome? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that many of us are pleasantly surprised with this ruling after watching the Constitution being reduced to a dead letter, it seems, in the recent past.
Jim, thanks for the call. Howard, a lot of people had their eyes on this one and were worried about what would happen if the court ruled the other way in favor of this state independent state legislature theory. What would have been potentially some of the consequences?
Well, for one thing, all independent districting commissions would become immediately invalidated. Right. So a number of states trying to get away from the partisanship that affects the way elections are run have independent commissions that nominate judges or draw voting district lines or come up with election rules. Had the theory been accepted, all of those would be deemed unconstitutional because they're not the legislature. There could even be an argument that legislatures are constitutionally prohibited from giving that authority to any kind of independent agency. So all attempts, essentially, at making elections less partisan and more fair would have been out the window. Second, there would have been just, I think what really motivated some of the justices in rejecting this theory is just that it would have been such uncharted territory. It's a completely unprecedented way to read the Constitution, completely unmoored from, no pun intended, from any other, the way we read the Constitution in any other context. And no one can guess what all of its consequences would have been. There's an interesting irony here, which is just a few years ago, in a case called Arizona Redistricting Commission, John Roberts wrote a dissenting opinion in which he said only the legislature can draw districts. Independent district drawing commissions are unconstitutional. At some point between then and now, he apparently changed his mind. And I think, if I had to guess, the two things that changed his mind, one, are just the radically unknown possibilities of where this might lead, and two, the perception of Jim and people like Jim, that this court, you know, was simply reducing constitutional protections to nothing. And I think that the recent very great criticism of the court and the recent scandals involving what appear to be financial improprieties with justices drives people like Roberts to want to step back a little and maybe step back from the brink.
Thanks for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. Howard, I want to go to potentially the most extreme interpretation here, the idea that, and you alluded to this earlier, in 2020, after the elections, after the votes were counted and the initial audits, calls in some states to say, hey, we don't like this outcome, or we think it was fishy. Lawmakers have the authority to go in post-vote and change who the electors go to in the election. Here in Wisconsin, there were a couple of Republican lawmakers, I'm talking low single digits here, who made that argument. That was rejected by their caucuses and their party. They didn't advance that idea. What do you make of that? Does this really put that idea to bed now, or is there still some morsel of a thought that that could happen?
Well, you have to view that particular idea that you're describing. And by the way, I don't think it's quite as few Wisconsin Republicans as you're suggesting, but that's a different discussion. In the context of a larger set of ideas. So the reason, one reason I always go back to Bush versus Gore is that while that case was based on very specific circumstances, the big message it sent out was, if you don't like the way an election came out, go to court. And think of 2020, the absolute test for a Trump Republican or a Trump loyal Republican these days is, do they accept the conspiracy theory that the 2020 election was stolen? And the Trump supporters tried to pursue that theory in courts and failed, tried to pursue it in Congress and failed, tried to pursue it in state legislatures and failed, have now started going after local election officials, including, for example, the chair of the Wisconsin Election Commission, who is going to be removed because she's been in conflict with election deniers in the Republican Party. This was the most extreme version, as you say, was the theory that took this strange theory of independent state legislatures and say, hey, we don't have to be bound by elections at all. I think that theory has been put to bed in the sense that I can't imagine a future court more extremely in that ideological space than the one we currently have now. But as I say, there were three votes in favor of it, so one should be cautious. What has certainly not been put to bed at all are attempts to find things outside the electoral process, whether it's lawsuits, weird constitutional theories, attempts to manipulate the personnel of local electoral elections administrative offices. That's going to continue. And I only see that getting worse. In a sense, the door has been opened and there have been no negative consequences to pursuing even the most outlandish theories. So I don't see, to be very specific, Trump supporting Republicans in 2024 being at all hesitant to pursue theories like this in state courts and lower federal courts and outside the court system altogether.
Here in Wisconsin, Howard, you mentioned that redistricting, which will likely hit our state Supreme Court soon, that may be a first test case post this Moore versus Harper decision. Could we see things like if the Supreme Court ruled on the state constitutionality of, I don't know, a voter ID law, a ballot box law, whatever, that might see similar challenges then in federal courts saying, let's see if this is the state court overstepping its bounds under this sort of vague outline that Justice Roberts laid out there?
Absolutely. And let's just take the example of districting for the moment. So I quite confidently expect that, you know, within a few months after August 1st, this Wisconsin Supreme Court will accept a challenge under the state constitution to the very, very gerrymandered districts in Wisconsin. Let's suppose, which I think is probable, that the court will strike them down. At that point, the ball goes in the court, so to speak, of the legislature, which is, of course, dominated by the same Republicans who created these districts. They will try and draw as gerrymandered a set of districts as they think they can get away with under whatever standard the state Supreme Court has announced. Governor Evers, a Democrat, will likely veto it. There will then be a fight between Evers and the legislature, probably with detours into the court to determine the separation of powers between those two branches, until eventually something exists that can then go back to the state Supreme Court and be evaluated under whatever standard they've set. You can see where this is going. All of this is an invitation to endless politicking and litigation. And anywhere along any of those steps, someone can go to someone from the legislature can go to a federal court and say, hey, under this Moore versus Harper standard, you know, we want you to say, or we want the Seventh Circuit, let's say, to say that the Wisconsin State Supreme has gone too far to interfere with the will of the legislature. And of course, the nature of a thing like gerrymandering or voter requirements is that they determine the makeup of the legislature. Every analysis that's ever been done over the last 20 years or so finds that without gerrymandering, there's no possibility that Republicans would have the kind of majorities that they have in the Wisconsin legislature. But this process that I'm describing is literally designed to prevent that situation from being effectively addressed for as long as possible. And by leaving the federal courts as players in this process, Robertson's majority opinion has left open the door to that kind of strategy.
Howard, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Howard Schwaber, professor of political science emeritus and affiliate faculty at the law school at UW-Madison. He joined us to break down this new Moore versus Harper U.S. Supreme Court decision, find out how it could affect future elections nationwide and here in Wisconsin. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin neuroscientist and clinical psychologist joins us to talk about the causes of and treatments for depression, as growing rates in national surveys of people report being diagnosed with the mental health condition. I'm Rob Ferret. You can find more conversations like these all the time, anytime, stream live at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You can also follow and share our archives there as well. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to an epidemiologist who sees the U.S. continuing a cycle of reduced resources for public health now that the COVID-19 pandemic has receded from public attention. Now, more and more people in the U.S. are reporting being diagnosed with depression. Recent polling from Gallup found that nearly 3 out of 10 people say they have been told by a doctor or nurse that they have depression at some point in their lives. That number has risen steadily from 2015, when the rate was only 2 out of 10. And the percentage of people who report currently having a depression diagnosis is up about 7% over that same time span. The CDC released a new report earlier this month that confirmed similar nationwide numbers as of 2020, and that CDC data showed Wisconsin ranked 23rd in the nation in rates of depression, right around 20%. We're exploring some of the possible causes and solutions to depression, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think might be causing this increase in the rate of diagnosis of depression? Are there solutions you think could start reverse this trend? If you've experienced depression yourself or in your family and are willing to share your story, love to hear from you. Was there a treatment that you found that worked? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Jack Nitschke is a clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. Jack, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hello, happy to be here.
Can you give us sort of the basic definition of depression from a clinical standpoint?
Yeah, so depression can occur in a number of different forms. The most common form is something that we technically talk about as major depressive disorder. And it is essentially a set of 9 different symptoms, one of which is depressed mood. Another of the common ones is not the inability to experience pleasure or not having interest in things that we usually are interested in. And then there's a set of other symptoms that include different things, including disturbances to sleep, either insomnia or sleeping too much called hypersomnia, disturbances with eating, having no appetite at all, or some people are depressed are suddenly eating a whole lot, as well as just symptoms like fatigue and feeling worthless, having trouble making up one's mind about something. So as you can see, depression involves a number of different symptoms here, and any individual might have some subset of those, but typically how we go about defining depression is that you have to have 5 out of these 9 symptoms.
Looking at these numbers with higher rates of depression diagnosis, that sounds bad. Certainly a lot of us are depressed and that's bad news, but it could also be that maybe we're paying more attention, we're seeking out treatment, we're doing a better job of screening for it. Do you have a sense of what might be driving that numbers? More depression, or we're more alert to depression?
So there are many factors that contribute to the cause of depression. And the question here with these latest data that have just come out is, what is leading to this increase currently? I don't think there's been a real stark increase in recent, just in the last couple of years in terms of just the increased awareness of it. Now, that may have been happened a little bit with the pandemic. It certainly happened a lot over the last 30 years. For a long period of time, we were not seeing increased numbers in depression, but we also weren't seeing decreased numbers in depression, despite the fact that we have now much better treatments for it. So this has been, an issue for us in the field of wanting to, have rates of depression decrease from what they are. So, but your question as to why are they increasing now, again, there could be several factors. I think one of the things we have to look at is the pandemic, which, thankfully we're on the backside of. But, during the pandemic, that certainly isolated folks. We know that social support is really good at helping keep depression at bay. But also the pandemic interrupted people's work and led to inflation by interrupting the supply chain. This led to financial stress. We know that financial stress is going to feed anxiety and depression. And so that too could in part be leading to higher rates of depression.
And you mentioned treatments for depression, and I want to definitely talk about that. What are the main kinds of treatment out there that seem to be proving effective, at least for some people experiencing depression?
Yeah, there's two basic classes of treatment that are kind of the front line of treatment. One is in the field of psychotherapy, and we have different treatments such as cognitive behavioral therapy, another type of treatment known as interpersonal therapy for depression, another treatment that's called ACT. And so there's a number of treatments that have been developed over the years that are very good and empirically we have evidence that really do help people get over their depressive episodes. On the flip side, for those who don't want to do some of the work that's involved with psychotherapy, there's also the possibility of taking medications. We have antidepressants that are very good for treating depression in a lot of individuals. And these are some, really some household names now, such as Prozac and Zoloft, as well as a host of others that have very similar chemical properties to those two. And that targets specific neurotransmitter systems in the brain. And those two have been found to be helpful with depression.
We're talking about depression, rising rates of depression diagnosis here in the United States, and treatments with Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Jack, a lot of your research, I know, involves the idea of neuroplasticity, and this is a key part of understanding how some of those treatments you talked about work. First of all, what do we mean by neuroplasticity?
So neuroplasticity is a set of brain mechanisms that are involved in helping us adapt to change and leading us to be able to do things such as learn. And so basically the idea here is that whatever it is that you're going to spend your time doing, particularly those things that you repeat over and over again, you will build neural connections that support that behavior or that thought or that feeling. And such that, if for example, in depression, something that's common is that you have a self-critical, you know, have self-critical thoughts. And if you think I'm no good, and we have maybe somebody that's told us we're not good enough when we're young children, and then we practice, and then we kind of hear that multiple times, and then we actually internalize that and walk around such that we're saying, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not good enough. Each time that that gets that repetition, it is strengthening those neural circuits that support that in our brain. And so then part of what we're doing with psychotherapy is actually going in and testing, is that true? Am I really not good at something? And for all of my patients, I find the good aspects of who they are. We talk about that and the evidence for that. And then what we're doing is slowly building neural connections that support the knowledge that they are indeed good people as they walk through their life.
And that plasticity idea, I could see somebody, especially in the midst of depression, saying all those things are carved in stone, the bad self-talk and things like that. But we can, if I'm hearing you right, Jack, have a new process of learning that gets a new set of connections, literally neural connections in our brain that provides an alternative?
Yeah, it's exactly right. And so, you know, you've talked about a little bit the bad news about neuroplasticity here. The bad news about neuroplasticity, if we do have these self-critical thoughts, is once that's been practiced along a lot, that's around essentially for the rest of our lives. Things that we have done a lot of repetition for, we are going to have neural connections that support that for the rest of our life. We can't go in and surgically remove that. So that's kind of the bad news. The good news, however, is that we can go and use those exact same neuroplasticity mechanisms to learn new truths about who we are and how we are able to handle situations. And then we can practice those, repeat that, such that we are building new neural circuits that more accurately reflect who we are, and that can help us to feel better.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Wauwatosa. Mike, hi.
Hello, sir.
What did you want to share with us, Mike?
I felt like my dad and I connected better altogether, and he's passed away, but my mom and I never saw things the same way. I'm just wondering, I got divorced 3 years ago, and I need some help.
Mike, I'm so sorry to hear all of that, and best to you. Now, Jack, obviously I won't ask you to diagnose and prescribe options for Mike, but for somebody in that position, very dark position in his life right now, what can people do to start seeking help?
Yeah, so what Mike is referring to or is indicating that he's struggling with is grief. And grief is a very close relative of depression, and it's associated with sadness. There's also other elements that can be present, other components of grief, including there can be feelings of anger there. There can be feeling times where one's in denial about having lost somebody, as well as there are periods of time maybe that Mike has where he is very much accepting that his father is not here, yet still has a great deal of sadness. We know with grief that grief is actually something that stays with us when you have somebody as close to us as it sounds like Mike was with his father, that grief will probably stay with Mike for much of his life, but it will take on different forms, such that when Mike is, you know, if is able to process some of this grief, talk through both the wonderful things about his dad and the connection that they had, as well as just acknowledging, you know, the sadness not only of losing his father, but also the end of that marriage. And to process that and work with that. And essentially, he's going to be to speak with speak to what I just spoke about with the neural connections. He's going to be building up some neural connections for how do you kind of walk through life without dad physically present here.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Best to you as you deal with all of that. And Jack, I wonder about, in addition to maybe one-on-one therapy, what do you think about support groups? Because obviously the people Mike would want to talk to things about in tough times, well, it's not an option now. Are there things like grief support groups or divorce support groups that people can at least get some of that from?
Absolutely. There are good grief support groups out there that will tell you a little bit about the different stages or components of grief, as well as just to have you be in a setting where you can be with other people who are also really struggling with the loss of somebody that they have loved very dearly, as it's really clear is the case for Mike.
We're talking to clinical psychologist and UW-Madison professor Jack Nitschke about depression and an increasing rate of patients receiving a diagnosis of depression over the last handful of years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think we could start to reduce rates of depression in our society, big picture and individually too? What questions do you have about the way we diagnose and treat depression? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison, looking at a growing number of people diagnosed with depression in the United States, what treatment and possible solutions are out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think it would take to improve mental health in our country? Do you have a question for our guest about diagnosis, treatment, the causes of depression? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Hey, here's another number. If you need it or a loved one needs it, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, that's a call or a text to 988. Again, that's 988. Jack, I want to talk a little more about the causes of depression. Sometimes we think of it as, you know, a traumatic maybe life event causing it. Sometimes we hear, at least in the past, I've heard about, you know, this is a brain chemistry thing. Are they both out there? Is it some of each? What do we think about the causes now?
Yeah, there are many factors that are causal in nature, you know, and one of the issues that I like to be really careful about being a neuroscientist myself is to move away from some thinking about, oh, this is just, you know, something that happens in the brain. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the brain is going to be involved in it. This is, you know, the organ that helps us have feelings and emotions. It mediates that process. But it's also really, really key that there are other components that contribute to that as well. And these components are things that are happening in our environment. They may be some things from childhood. They could be trauma that can lead to profound feelings of depression and trauma of all different sorts. And they can also be things that happen to us later in life, difficulties with with employment or losing a friend. And then importantly, as we just heard about, is, you know, the end of a marriage potentially can be a cause for depression, as well as sometimes losing somebody goes beyond just the grief, but can be a more protracted period of depression that some people experience after losing a loved one. So exact nature of what the cause of depression is really multifactorial.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Sauk City. Jackie, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jackie?
I just wanted to say I'm a community psychiatric nurse, and so I was listening to the program and was very interested in what Mike had to say. And I just feel like your speaker didn't necessarily point him into a direction that could be helpful, and I would encourage Mike to seek help from his primary care doctor, who could possibly assess him for suicidality, and then get him started on an antidepressant if the doctor felt that was necessary, and then refer him to outpatient psychiatric treatment somewhere.
Jackie, thanks for that call. And Jack, I've heard and I've talked to guests about, making sure that more primary care physicians are doing these kind of screenings for depression and other mental health needs, making the kind of referrals Jackie is talking about. Do you feel like we're getting better at doing those things?
I don't know what Jackie thinks about it. I think we are getting better at doing those. And Jackie's certainly right on spot on in terms of the recommendations she's making there. Our primary care physicians are oftentimes very good at helping to manage. And indeed, a number of people will just be on an antidepressant medication that their primary care physician is that is managing. So, and then it's, you know, and then a lot of times, as Jackie just alluded to, it can be very helpful for the primary care physician to say, oh, this is looking a little bit more complex, might be a benefit to have some psychotherapy, or and if the depression gets really bad over a period of time, so there's also some other forms of treatment that can be utilized that have been shown to be helpful, and to make that referral to mental health, behavioral health services.
Jackie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jack, do we have enough services available for people who are seeking help, who do need help, or is it hit or miss depending on where we are?
In terms of psychiatric services, I would say we do not have enough. I'm part of a big department here in Madison, so associated with the University of Wisconsin, our Department of Psychiatry, and it has been something that we have really worked very hard to meet and provide access to all the people in the community who are asking for services. It's become even a greater need since the pandemic. We've increased the numbers of our providers multiple fold, and we still are not able to meet all the need in the community. This is a place where indeed, though, primary care physicians do help out. So when somebody has a form of depression that is more manageable, that can be overseen by a primary care physician doc, and that is happening, you know, increasingly.
I want to get back to the idea of neuroplasticity. Another thing you work on is human brain imaging. I mean, are we at a point where we could image our brain and see ourselves making these connections to counter the paths we've built up in the past when it comes to things like depression?
No, we're not at that point, and I don't know that we will necessarily get to that point with brain imaging. Mm. The brain imaging is not at nearly as molecular of a level as that, so it's looking at more different areas of the brain, how different areas are involved when it's done with depression and anxiety, how different areas of the brain are involved differentially on different types of tasks. One thing that's become really clear from the last 30 years of the huge amount of brain imaging work that's now been done is that there is no center in the brain that is the source of depression here, and that it's a much more complicated picture than that. And I think one of some of this work that's been done with neuroplasticity and an understanding that can really help understand what is going on in a person's brain as this depression is developing, as well as when they're getting effective treatment.
And we've been focusing on individual diagnosis and treatment a lot here, Jack. Getting back to, you know, this overall increase in depression, you mentioned earlier, you know, isolation from COVID, disruption from COVID might have been a cause of that increase. Does that point us towards some society-wide solutions? Are there things we could do as a country that might build those connections, do things that help prevent people being depressed in the first place?
Yeah, I think there certainly are with some of that. I mean, so one is just policies that we are going to have. So I think, you know, in terms of, having, making sure that employment and income is being supported so that people can, meet the cost of living, making sure that we're keeping an eye on inflation and keeping the cost of living down that way. So I think there's policy work that can be done there. And then I think there's things we can do in the community really to encourage the social support that people can have access to, encourage kind of community involvement so that people can turn to people when they are feeling, when they are struggling. One of the things that you've mentioned here is the 988 number. That's just a crisis line. It's also a suicide hotline. That's, you know, another good tool that's just come online, the 988 specifically. There was a much longer 800 number that was used for many years prior to that. But this 988 number just allows for more accessibility for people to get the help and the support they need.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That's Jack Nitschke, clinical psychologist, neuroscientist, and associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about why we're seeing more and more of it in the U.S., what we can do about it. And again, that number 988 for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. You can call or text 988. tomorrow on The Morning Show. Forensic science looks really impressive in police procedural shows on TV, but reality doesn't always match up with the fiction. Find out more in a new book from The Innocence Project. Check it out. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8. You can listen online at WPR.org or live here on the Ideas Network. I pretty much always have a song stuck in my head. Sometimes it's something I like, so that's okay. Sometimes it's something I don't like, and I try to get it out of there. And sometimes it's something really random, like my current song. Yes, last night a junk food TV commercial from my childhood popped into my head. Why? Well, I was grocery shopping, but I didn't even go to the aisle with all the chips. I haven't munched that particular product for at least a couple of few years. I found the commercial online this morning. There's a kid in the commercial who looked a lot like me as a kid. I even had a shirt kind of like his. I was never in a Fritos commercial or any commercial. Anyhow, I eagerly await the next selection in my brain's playlist to knock the commercial jingle out of the way. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.